From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're keeping an eye on those chemical fires at a plant in the Houston area. We're going to get the latest on that in just a minute. But first, the threat of serious flooding remains high along the Texas-Louisiana line. In Houston, the fire department is conducting a block-by-block search to find victims and survivors. Here's FEMA Director Brock Long speaking this morning.
We're discussing things not only about restoring basic routines such as power and how we bring schools back up online, but we're also talking about how to deal with massive amounts of debris, as well as the most important thing, the mission of saving houses.
Joining us now is Craig Cohen, host of Houston Matters at Houston Public Media. And Craig, at this point, how much of Houston is still flooded and what's it like in some of those neighborhoods?
Well, first, let me share the good news with you, Jeremy. Central portions of the city of Houston are drier now after a full day of sunshine. Metro, which provides citywide bus service, has resumed limited service on major routes today. The two major Houston airports, Bush and Hobby, north and south of the city, respectively, reopened late Wednesday afternoon with limited flights. But there's still massive flooding in outlying areas, even as most of the major bayous and the reservoirs have now crested. There's still flooding in rivers and streams, and there are still whole neighborhoods flooded. As for who's affected, everyone is in some way. Even folks in those neighborhoods that have largely stayed dry are still finding debris on roadways as waters recede. There are now under 100 high water locations reported on Houston, greater Houston roads. That's down from 450 at its peak.
And in terms of the responders in the city, are they still out doing rescues, or has that phase passed in Houston proper?
They're still out there. They have been working around the clock for, what is it now, 4 or 5 days. And that's put a strain on them, but they continue to pursue. I think we had somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 rescues yesterday, and it continues to happen.
There are also dangers out there for ordinary people. A 25-year-old man was electrocuted and died after stepping into floodwater there.
Yeah, it's awful, but that is a reminder to all of us that we don't know what's in the water. And so you do, if you can at all possible avoid floodwaters, you should not wade into them.
What's the situation at the 3 mega shelters in Houston at this point?
Well, the Red Cross today began moving evacuees from smaller shelters into one of the much larger ones, the mega shelter at NRG Center. Harris County Judge Ed Emmett yesterday opened that center. It can accommodate about 10,000 people displaced by the storm. The shelter at NRG includes an on-site clinic and pharmacy, a grocery and clothing store, transportation to other stores nearby. There's even an on-site theater for kids, and I just heard a little while ago about a group of volunteer teachers who have come to help out at NRG. Yesterday, the line of just volunteers coming to help there snaked around the complex. Meanwhile, across Houston, the shelters at the George R. Brown Convention Center and the Toyota Center remain open. You might remember at the GRB, they were concerned about the numbers peaking close to 10,000. Those numbers have now fallen as people have either been rerouted to other shelters or in some cases to hotels, or in some cases they've been able to return to their homes.
Or go and stay with friends or family, perhaps, if those houses have been dried out enough to do that. What about the situation northeast of Houston, Craig, in Port Arthur, which was hit very hard, and Beaumont, where there is apparently no running water?
Right. Okay. So Beaumont is about 100 miles east of Houston. It lost its water supply because of Harvey. Officials say the city lost service from its main pump station due to rising waters at the Neches River. The pump station's along the river, and it draws water from it as a main source for the city's water system. The city also lost a secondary water source at the Loeb Wells in Hardin County. There's no word on when water service will be restored, but they're going to have to wait until water levels from Harvey recede before they can determine the extent of the damage.
And what about gas shortages in the region? Another concern that we're hearing about because a big pipeline is being shut down.
Yeah, Colonial Pipeline shut down fuel lines from Houston through southern states and up the East Coast. Its facilities are outside of Lake Charles, Louisiana, and those are out of service. There have been other Harvey-related shutdowns of refineries, so Colonial's already suspended operations transporting diesel and aviation fuel. They're going to do the same for a line carrying gasoline today. Could this mean gas shortages? Possibly. Could it mean higher prices? Possibly. Understand when I said earlier everyone's affected, I'm not just just talking about Greater Houston. This area is touted as the energy capital of the world. There are oil refineries up and down the east side of Houston and oil and gas producers and headquarters on the west side. Oil and gas is our dominant industry here, and though Houston's much more diversified than it was in the 80s, oil and gas still dominate. So it's just not surprising to learn that as those refineries and other facilities shut down, that may also mean eventually companies that operate pipelines have to shut down.
That's Craig Cohen, host of Houston Matters on Houston Public Media. Craig, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, there are also many chemical plants in the region, so let's get to those fires at the Arkema peroxide plant in Crosby, Texas. They had been feared as the plant flooded, and early this morning, the Harris County Fire Marshal's office reported a series of chemical reactions and smoke at the plant. 15 deputies who were there establishing a perimeter were sent to the hospital after inhaling the fumes. All have been released. At a press conference this morning, Crosby Sheriff Ed Gonzalez downplayed the dangers of the fumes.
Arkema company officials and the Harris County Fire Marshal's Office have told us that exposure to smoke from these organic peroxides is similar to standing over a burning campfire. Based on this information, we believe the smoke is a non-toxic irritant.
Reporter Mose Bouchel of member station KUT has been following this story. He joins us now from Austin. And Mose, so the sheriff there said the fumes were non-toxic, like a campfire. But FEMA Administrator Brock Long said the plumes from the chemical release at the plant are incredibly dangerous. What do they contain? Remind us what's there.
So this is a plant that, as the sheriff said, processes organic peroxides. What they make are material to make like PVC pipe or even like kitchen countertop material. And this stuff needs to be kept refrigerated. And this is what's happened here at the plant. The flooding over the weekend it cut out power to the plant, and then it cut out backup generators of the plant. Mm-hmm. And so then you had these canisters full of this chemical that were just sitting there getting warmer than they should get. And at that point, people knew there was going to be a problem. On Tuesday, they evacuated the plant. They evacuated people around the plant and are essentially waiting for this chemical fire to take place because they knew once the temperatures rose enough, something like this would happen.
Okay, well, what do we do about the discrepancy? Is it dangerous or not? Incredibly dangerous?
That's a good question.
Yeah,
you know, the EPA has just announced that they're flying aircraft around it. What they've said is that they don't believe that in the concentrations they are detecting, it poses a threat. And that's a little bit different from saying it's not dangerous. And just hearing that soundbite that you played, I wouldn't want to put myself over a campfire and inhale. I mean, obviously, smoke is dangerous.
Yeah.
So what the EPA is now saying is that they have aircraft going over this and that they haven't detected concentrations that could pose a threat, but that they're willing to exercise any authority that they have to ensure public safety.
Okay, well, Arkema's Richard Renard, he's president of their acrylic monomers division, called Harvey an unprecedented storm, and he apologized at a press conference. Let's listen.
Certainly, on behalf of all of the employees at Arkema, I want to apologize for the impact that this is having on the local community. We certainly appreciate all of the work that the responders are doing to help protect the safety of those in the area, and that's our primary objective, and we're going to continue to do that.
Well, he also said he expects the 8 other containers will burn out like the first container did. And by the way, these weren't explosions. They're sort of pops, they were explaining, and they're burning out. But
right.
In the reporting up to this, there were questions about whether the plant had another substance on hand to neutralize the peroxide. What are the questions there?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are some questions as to whether the plant should have done more. And as things stood, they made the call that they just had to get people out of the way, essentially. They clearly had one backup, a kind of plan B when it comes to these backup generators. But when you're dealing with chemicals that are this volatile, mm-hmm. People are also going to be asking whether plan C should have been in order or plan D. What we're seeing now is the result of that plan B failing.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that these questions will be ongoing.
Well, as we just heard, Texas represents, you know, the oil industry, but also about 40% of U.S. petrochemical manufacturing. The Houston Corpus Christi region has a lot of industrial plants. So how at risk are others? And not just from this kind of, you know, losing the cooling and perhaps having fires, but they're flooding and substances might be washing into the environment. So what are the concerns?
Yeah, there have been a lot of concerns raised by public health advocates in the wake of the storm and the flooding. Houston's home to around like 450 petrochemical plants. And This is the most dramatic example right now of what's happened in this storm, but other plants have flooded. Other refineries have been damaged by the storm, and those facilities shut down generally when they're at risk. And even the very act of shutting down and restarting emits toxic chemicals into the air more than these places normally emit. And so we are hearing calls from neighborhoods who are complaining about weird smells. We're hearing calls from public health advocates who are saying that we need to be watching what this vast refining industry is putting into the air in the wake of Hurricane Harvey.
Mose Bushel of member station KUT. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rob.
Yesterday, we spoke with Christian Picciolini, a former skinhead who founded the group Life After Hate, which rehabilitates violent white supremacists. We'll post our talk at hereandnow.org. It is fascinating. But among the things Christian told us, before he left the movement, his and other hate groups made a concerted effort to blend in.
When we recognized that the average American white racist was put off by our edginess, we decided to tone it down, to grow our hair out and to wear suits instead of boots, to go to college campuses and recruit, to get jobs in law enforcement and join the military to get training and to even run for office.
Well, that left us with a question. How big is the modern white supremacist movement? And is the Trump administration shifting its focus from these white supremacist groups to exclusively pursuing Muslim extremists? Many point to the Department of Homeland Security canceling an Obama-era grant to Picciolini's group as proof that they are. As we said yesterday, we want to look broader, so let's do that now with David Shanzer, director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University. Professor, welcome.
Hello.
Let's take that last question first. Homeland Security officials told us they are not narrowing their focus. But John Cohen, a former official, says cutting Picciolini's and other grants geared toward fighting white supremacy is a clear signal that the only threat this administration is interested in regarding violent extremism is the radical Islamist threat. Now, I know that you were actually a consultant to one of the grants that got cut there at the University of North Carolina. But do you think this administration is trying to jettison programs that want to work with white supremacists in favor of just looking for Muslim extremists?
Like so many things with this administration, their message is really frequently muddled. And, of course, you have the president's tweets, which are then parsed to try to figure out what the administration wants to do. So I'm in the position where I just look at their actions. And I do agree that there's really unjustifiable to cut that grant. There were $10 million worth of grants, and very few of them were going to be focused on right-wing extremism. So I do believe that that was a signal. And you have some administration officials who, you know, gave strength to that view because of some of their rhetoric.
Well, you have people like Sebastian Gorka, who has left the administration. But after Charlottesville, he dismissed concerns about white nationals. He went on Breitbart News. New York Times reports he says, it's this constant, oh, it's the white man, it's the white supremacist, that's the problem. No, it isn't. And many people point to the fact that his wife, Catherine, has been integral in developing the Homeland Security Department's programs on extremism. That's, you know, where she works. So people point to that. But do you think this is just a Trump administration problem?
Well, I don't think the Obama administration really did a tremendous amount on right-wing extremism. You know, there was that kerfuffle early in the when Janet Napolitano was at DHS and a report came out that talked about the spike in right-wing extremism and talked about the threats of, you know, former Iraq war veterans going into this movement. And, you know, I think that was right. The data definitely shows that it was right, but there was an extreme backlash. And I think ever since then, at the beginning of the administration, they actually defunded some of the analytic units that were looking at right-wing extremism. And I didn't really see much of an emphasis on that. And I think they were doing some, but not really a tremendous focus on this problem either.
We'll talk about the problem. You say, look at the data. Your group, the Triangle Center, talked to law enforcement agencies. What did they tell you?
Yes, this was a survey. It was done a number of years ago, 2014, but we were surprised when we just asked, what is your general sense of the threat from these different types of extremism? And they reported to a fairly significant basis that they felt that right-wing extremism in their jurisdiction was a bigger threat than the ones coming from inspired by Al-Qaeda and ISIS. It's interesting because law enforcement are the targets of some of these right-wing extremist threats. The Sovereign mm-hmm. Citizens movement actually, you know, sometimes is engaged in murder of police officers. So that is what could have been motivating those survey results to some extent.
Well, the FBI and Homeland Security did a report together, found white supremacists responsible for 49 homicides and 26 attacks over the past 16 years, more than any other group of domestic extremists. But and what about what we were hearing from Christian Picciolini about the fact that it's a different face of white supremacy? Is that what you're finding as well?
You know, the whole alt-right movement, to me, is just in some ways a repackaging of the old racism. I just think that because of the political moment we're in, they're just more emboldened, more feeling empowered to speak out and be involved in politics. And that's what we're seeing about these violent clashes.
And how big a movement is it?
I think we shouldn't overemphasize it. I do believe that this is on the fringe of American politics. As a matter of fact, just here in Durham last week, there was just a rumor that there was going to be a neo-Nazi march in downtown Durham. And 500 people, counter-demonstrators, showed up, and there actually was no protest. And the same thing happened in Boston, where the counter-protesters overwhelmed. So this is a fringe movement. I think one little piece of data that I think is useful is the Daily Stormer is this very prevalent white supremacist website. They said they had 300,000 subscribers. Their website's being taken down, actually. They're looking for a new host. But, you know, so that can give you a little bit of an indication about how many people are engaged in this movement.
Well, but many are pointing to recent polling that shows more Americans than ever are in favor of interracial marriages. I think from both parties, Republican and Democrat, 9 out of 10 said that they would be in favor of an African-American from their party being president. I mean, the polls show that Americans are actually moving in a very different direction. So does concentrating on this maybe blow it up in a way that it doesn't deserve? Or do you think we have to be mindful and talk about extremism?
Well, the answer is both, really. It's a tiny amount of violence when we look at the amount of violence in American society. We have 14,000 murders, 15,000 per year, and we're looking at hundreds of homicides by extremists of either stripe over the course of a decade and a half. So it's a tiny, tiny fraction of the violence. But this violence has a wider impact. It affects our social cohesion. It pits Americans against each other. So I do think it's an important problem. But what extremists do is they try to make themselves seem more powerful, more prevalent than they really are by their outrageous actions. You can look at the 9/11 attack as, of course, a perfect example of that. So these organizations remain fringe. I believe they're inherently weak. But that doesn't mean they should be ignored. These are problems that still have to be addressed in a sensitive way.
David Schanzer, director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University. David, Professor Schanzer, thank you.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Let's return to our top story now, the impact of Harvey on the Gulf Coast. And let's go back a week to the storm's arrival. Some of the very first evacuees from Harvey were newborns in intensive care. They were flown out of a Corpus Christi hospital last weekend before the storm hit and are now in Fort Worth at Cook Children's Medical Center. Stella Chavez from KERA has the story of one mom and her baby girl.
Aunque mis ojos no te puedan ver.
A few weeks ago, Nareida Rangel was singing to her newborn daughter at a children's hospital in Corpus Christi. Shaddai Jire Leha was born premature. She has a congenital heart defect that left holes in her heart. It's hard for her to breathe. One time, her blood pressure dropped and her face turned purple.
Whoa, whoa, mi corazón.
Having a child in a hospital is hard for any mom. As Shaddai was fighting for her life, Harvey was brewing in the Gulf of Mexico, heading for Corpus Christi. Driscoll Children's Hospital decided to evacuate. Rangel wasn't sure if she'd be allowed to travel with her baby. She prayed.
¿Tú tienes el poder para parar este huracán?
I said to God, you have the power to stop this hurricane or to help me with my daughter.
A paramedic came into the room and told her, "You ready, mommy? Vámonos. Let's go." She had 20 minutes to pack. She moved quickly, despite the pain from her C-section. Shaddai was among 10 babies flown on small jets from Corpus Christi to Fort Worth's Cook Children's Medical Center. The hospital does these transports every day, 3,000 a year. Debbie Boudreau is program director for the hospital program called Teddy Bear Transport.
Every day when we go on a transport, we take Pandora's box of equipment with us in the event we never really know what we're going to get, so we're always prepared for the worst, hoping for the best.
Patients who weigh 10 pounds or less are placed on a portable incubator attached to a ventilator. Boudreau has been doing this 30 years. She has 3 sons of her own.
You are taking someone's most prized possession away from them. And so my job and the job of my staff is to ensure them that we were going to take care of those children as if they were our very own.
Hospital officials say some of the babies could be returning to Corpus Christi soon. Nereida Rangel isn't sure when she and her daughter will go back. Shaddai will need heart surgery soon. Her faith gives her hope.
Es un milagro. Mi hija es un milagro de Dios.
It's a miracle. My daughter is a miracle from God. She's alive because of him. He's with us and has never left us alone.
For now, Rangel spends all day by her daughter's side, singing and praying. Harvey may have forced them to move across the state, 400 miles from home, but this mother and her baby girl are together. For Here and Now, I'm Stella Chavez.
And while we've been focused on the flooding from Harvey, there is another flood disaster unfolding on the other side of the world, in South Asia. More than 1,200 people have died and tens of thousands more have been displaced by rising waters caused by heavy rains. Joining us now is the BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar in Delhi. And Sanjoy, place this flooding on a map for us. What parts of South Asia are being affected?
Well, Jeremy, really the worst affected areas are basically Nepal, which is north of India, and it's really the eastern half of the country leading into eastern India and then southeast of that into Bangladesh. So you can get a sense that it's somewhat connected. And it's basically the fact that rivers, most of the major rivers in this part of the region, flow in from the Himalayas, which begin in Nepal, and then flow down south from eastern India and then onwards to Bangladesh before they empty into the Bay of Bengal. And what's been happening for the past few weeks is, of course, we're in the monsoon season, so it sees a lot of rain in any case. But this year, the rain has been a little more severe than normal. And so many of these rivers have simply overflowed. And so the flooding began in Nepal several weeks ago. And then through much of the eastern part of India, flooding sort of vast acres of farmland, sending many villages sort of in its wake. And then going down south into Bangladesh, and it's the northern part of that country, which is particularly badly affected.
And what about a place like Mumbai, which is, of course, no stranger to monsoons and to heavy rain? Is it worse than usual there?
Well, what happened in Mumbai this week was that over a 24-hour period, they got very, very heavy rain, something like 33 centimeters in a very short span of time. Now, Mumbai, of course, is used to monsoons every year, but it's also a city which is built up quite a bit. It's a city of more than 20 million people. It's got very tall buildings. And what's happened over time is because of all the construction and as the city's expanded, it's really made it very difficult then for the water to actually flow out into the sea when it rains heavily. And that's why many of the roads get flooded. In some areas, the flooding was really severe. You had cars floating in the water, a bit like the images we've seen of Houston over the past few days or so. But it only happened for a 24-hour period, and then it slowly sort of came back to normal. But a lot of people were very badly affected.
Are there systems in place to help stop the flooding or respond when it happens in these areas?
Well, the biggest criticism that environmentalists have made is that cities like Mumbai and even other parts of South Asia simply haven't learned their lessons. 12 years ago in 2005, Mumbai had very, very bad floods, which lasted for several days. The airport, and it's the largest international airport in the country, was shut down for 3 days because part of the runway was flooded. And the reason is because a lot of the natural drainage systems in the city, so sort of rivers or streams which flow in and then flow into the river, or little sort of channels of water which drain the water away have either been built over, blocked, or simply not cleaned up, or encroached upon as the city's expanded. And so there's no natural outlet for the water. And what happens is it then basically flows back into the city. And that's something that simply hasn't been addressed, despite the fact that, you know, the city experiences it every single year.
That's the BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar joining us from Delhi. Sanjoy, thank you.
Great to speak to you. Thank you.
So how are businesses in Houston faring? Well, Whataburger, the popular regional fast food chain, had several stores flood so quickly employees were trapped inside. All 55 stores in Houston were closed. But a photo of one of Whataburger's battered but still standing iconic W signs went viral with the caption, "Gave proof through the night that our flag was still there." As in most places, Houstonians love their regional retailers, and the feeling is mutual. You've no doubt heard about Houston's Jim Mattress Mac Mackingvale, owner of Gallery Furniture, same-day delivery.
You want your furniture delivered when? You want it tonight? No problem. Hey, load up the red one. At Gallery Furniture, we maintain
well,
a huge
Well, Jim
fleet of
went out and picked up survivors. They've been sleeping on his mattresses ever since. It all started when a woman and a young child came in at 2 a.m. at the height of the storm.
The child's crying, shaking. She comes to me at the front desk and she says, "Can we stay here?" My father never could say no. I don't either.
That was Jim on CBS TV. Well, then there's the San Antonio-based HEB, the 112-year-old, 350-store grocery chain. Scott McClellan is the company's Houston division president, and he joins us. And Scott, on Tuesday, we know you went to a store in Cyprus. It didn't have water, milk, bread, eggs, or meat, but there were 200 people waiting for it to open. Look, you're a business. But what's it like to see that crowd and know your business is also life-saving?
Yeah, it is. You know, it was amazing to walk in. I don't think I've ever seen one of our stores with poor conditions. I don't think I've ever seen our employees working harder. But maybe most amazingly, I don't think I've ever seen customers happier that we were open. It was a rough day for everyone, but we worked very hard through the day, and customers bought what was on the shelves, and we're working hard to replenish now. You know, it was a heroic effort for our hourly employees and for our managers just to get to the store because water levels were very high in the neighborhood. For me to get out to that store, I had to go down some streets and then back up and turn around because water levels were so high. And as I would come out, you would see some trucks with bass boats behind them. Who are going into neighborhoods to save people. And I think the narrative that you're going to see coming out of this is Texans didn't wait for other people to come save them. The Texans took matters into their own hands and that they were going to go and fight Harvey head on as best that they could.
Well, tell us more about what that means for a grocery chain. One of my favorite stories about HEB is that apparently the flooding broke windows and doors at one of your store locations. And there were people who climbed in. And these were evacuees. And I guess from your central area, people could see them from San Antonio on security cameras, tried to use a GPS device to call them on their cell phones. When they couldn't do that, spoke to them over the loudspeaker system and told them where to get to the highest point in the store so they'd be safe.
Yes, that's it exactly. So this is an area of town that historically floods. The people's home had flooded, and they had trudged through waist-deep water to get to our store. We saw them on our security camera and told them to get it on top of our check stands because that would be the highest level in the store. From there, then we contacted 911, and we were able to get a boat sent to pick them up in the store. And here's the most amazing thing is before they left the store, they repositioned the sandbags in front of the door that was broken so that more water wouldn't come into the store. And so that's the way here when we first saw them coming in, we thought they were looters. They weren't looters. They were people concerned about their own safety. And before they left the store better than when they came in.
Look, you're running an emergency operation in addition to trying to get your stores up and running. We want to hear about that. But first, let's listen to a little of a video that's posted on your website about the Emergency Operations Center. Your CEO, Craig Boyan, is talking to one of the employees who's organizing the ice orders.
Yeah, so far we've sent out just over 84 truckloads of ice to our retail stores and another 13 truckloads to support some of the donation stations throughout the Gulf Coast and Houston. And that equates to just north of 400,000 bags of ice have gone out just over the past two and a half days. So
we're getting ice from how far away now?
We're getting ice actually from Mississippi, Oklahoma, Dallas, and we're also looking at some of the other perimeter states. Right.
of course, ICE imperative when people don't have power and there's food to be kept. You're flying in drivers by helicopters, deploying over 1,000 employees to Houston from other places. And tell us about these food trucks you're running.
Sure. So I just came this morning from one of our mobile kitchens that we have at a Red Cross evacuation center in town, where we fed breakfast to 2,000 evacuees. And kind of the genesis of this idea came from a guy who worked for us, who back in the 1960s had been in the military and worked on a truck that had been outfitted with a kitchen. And he said it was very dangerous. And so over a couple of beers one night on a cocktail napkin, he sketched out what he thought a kitchen could look like. And so based on his idea, we built one. And now we take them into areas where disasters have occurred, whether it's a tornado or a hurricane. When the fires hit in Bastrop a couple of years ago, we went in and fed all the first responders for 3 days so they didn't have to eat MREs. And it's part of our corporate culture at HEB. When there's problems or trouble in an area, HEB shows up first, and we're there to help our communities.
Well, and you, and this is why you call people like that guy with the cocktail napkin your partners, not your employees.
That's right.
You're also deploying mobile pharmacies, check cashing services. But we've heard that there have been problems in other stores of price gouging, the Texas Attorney General cracking down on that today. Houston convenience store charged $20 for a gallon of gas. Other businesses at one point selling bottled water for $99 a case instead of $10. Best Western cut ties with a, you know, Best Western motel that jacked up prices. Have you been seeing this?
You know, we haven't been looking around, but I think a couple of stories that are interesting. One, you heard the video clip on the ice. We give ice away. We don't charge for it. And back when Hurricane Ike hit in 2008, we gave away tens of thousands of bags of ice. And even today, you know, 9 years later, people will come up and remind me that HEB gave ice away.
Is that what it's about? I want to ask you about that, because this is, you know, maybe you even have an account that takes care of this, you know, some sort of insurance account or, you know, but is this about the fact that you need these people in this community to continue to be your customers?
Well, I think what we find is that, look, if you help to make your community a better place, then it pays off for everyone. And if you invest back in the community, then a rising tide raises all ships. And so we just look to do what's right for the overall community. With regard to hotels, one of the things we do is today we'll have 2,000 of our employees, our partners, come in from San Antonio and Austin and the Rio Grande Valley to help us get our stores back up and running in Houston. And then tomorrow we'll get them over to Beaumont, because Beaumont is inaccessible today. And for hotels that still don't have power, we'll hook up generators to them, and we'll say to them, look, we'll rent out your entire hotel or motel, but it's going to be an HEB motel, and we'll give you power. And they just become an HEB village that's powered by us. And so actually the motel works or hotel works out well for them, because they're able to get full occupancy. And the only way that they're able to open up is because we supply them with the power. And it's funny, the people who volunteer from other parts of the company really look forward to coming over. They work very long days and they work very hard, but it's almost like a badge of honor or a badge of courage to get to come over and do this. And
yeah.
At the last hurricane, we said, well, what would you like and as a reward for doing this? And they said, could you make a pin for us that we could put on our name badge that showed we were a part of this? And people reflect back after many years of service to the company, and they will say, you know, one of my favorite times of working at HEB was when I went and had the opportunity to make a difference in people's lives when I worked in some natural disaster. And I think all people in life want to be able to make a difference in other people's lives, and here's a chance where we're able to do that and make our cities a better place to live.
That's Scott McClelland, the Houston division president of the chain store HEB. Scott, we just wish you all the best there. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. And nice talking to you. And thank you for giving this good coverage. And we just ask for prayers and hope to bring our area back.
Okay. You got them. Thank you.
Elections in Germany are less than a month away. Angela Merkel seems poised for a fourth term as chancellor, but her campaign hasn't been completely smooth sailing.
Im Kern geht es Sie.
Those voices in the background, people booing Merkel and heckling her as she tried to speak to a rally in Brandenburg this week. Joining us now, the BBC's Jenny Hill in Berlin. Jenny, why did this heckling take place earlier this week?
This actually has happened a few times now, and it's down to a small party called Alternative for Deutschland, or AfD. They have grown in popularity in Germany over the last few years, primarily because they very much campaigned on an anti-immigrant ticket. And they became very popular during the refugee crisis of the last couple of years. Actually, support for them has faded away, but it's not disappeared entirely. And they are on course to win seats in the national parliament here for the very first time in the autumn election. There is, I think, when I travel around the country, particularly into what was the East, the Old East, there is a sense of concern about Mrs. Merkel's having opened the door to hundreds of thousands of refugees. And there is a lingering resentment there. When you crunch the numbers and you look at it, they're not really having an effect on Mrs. Merkel's popularity. But there is still that concern there. And that's why at some of these rallies, you do see that kind of activity, that kind of heckling.
Has she changed any of her policies on accepting migrants as a result of the backlash?
Yeah, she has. Some of them very publicly, some of them rather more quietly. So, for example, her government has sped up the deportation of people who don't get asylum here. They've made it easier to throw foreign-born criminals out of the country. They've made those kind of activities very, very public indeed. And they've also, for example, nominated certain countries, among them the Balkan states, as so-called safe countries of origin, which means if you come from one of those countries, you have no automatic right to claim asylum here in Germany. And then there are those other policies too. So very quietly talking about, thinking about banning the full face veil in public and so on. So Mrs. Merkel has undoubtedly moved slightly towards, if you like, the right of politics in an attempt to mollify some of the people who are concerned by what happened here in the last couple of years and who are turning towards Alternative for Deutschland instead. She has recovered some of those voters, it must be said. Like I said before, AfD has dwindled in support, but it's not going away. And its voice is very, very loud, as Mrs. Merkel discovered herself.
And Merkel is still likely to be the next chancellor.
Yes, she is. Unless something really dramatic happens between now and the 24th of September, Angela Merkel is going to walk into the chancellery for a fourth term. She's been in the office now for 12 years. There are very many reasons for the likelihood of her re-election. But I think the most prominent among them is that, especially now in a world where we've seen Brexit and we've seen Donald Trump's election, many people in Germany really view her as a symbol, if you like, of stability and security in a world which is changing and is really, really shifting, and to many people here feels rather insecure. Merkel represents, yeah, as I say, stability. You know what you're going to get with Merkel. And I think that's why, whilst for some people she's a rather boring option, they'd rather stick with the devil they know.
Well, because she has become such a global leader, how does she thread that needle between dealing with German politics and being one of the leaders of Europe and having to do things that the Germans may not like, but that are better for Europe as a whole?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, because when you speak to people, there are undoubtedly voters who are concerned that she spends too much time dealing with international issues and she should turn her attentions to problems at home. Mrs. Merkel has been, I think, lucky in some respects. You know, as one senior MP said to me a week or so back, you know, Germany pretty much runs itself. It's got a good civil service. It's got a strong economy. But look further down the line. There are going to be problems with the economy in the future if Mrs. Merkel, if she gets in, doesn't start to address digitalization, globalization. The German economy, its manufacturing sector is, of course, very strong. But, you know, take diesel cars, for example. You know, Germany has really put its eggs into the basket of diesel. Well, we know what happened with the diesel scandal.
Right.
And we know that it hasn't really invested in, for example, electric vehicles. A lot of issues to be dealt with at home. So Mrs. Merkel, if she's elected, will have to be dealing with those.
So remind us how this all works on September 24th. How does Germany's election system operate?
Well, the actual process itself is pretty simple. Germany will go to the polls on the Sunday. Polls will close. There'll be exit polls a couple of hours later, and it'll be the early hours of the morning German time. The results will be announced. It's not the sort of same drama that's perhaps attached to other elections around the world where you see counts coming in from all different parts of the country. You just get one election result here. It's a pretty complicated election system, though. Germans actually, on their polling cards, have to vote first for the candidate they require and they would like to see in, regardless of party. And then they have a second vote for the party, which means that you get a sense of which party is the most popular. And as a result of a very complicated electoral system, that actually influences the number of seats in parliament. But at the same time, the direct vote for the candidate is also, of course, what determines which MPs will take place in the next Bundestag.
That's the BBC's Jenny Hill joining us from Berlin with a look ahead to the German elections next month. Jenny, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.